Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's January 20, 2017 program. Running the Gauntlet, the challenges of harassment experienced by our minority students. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, City Club Board President. Our sponsors today are Housing and Community Services Agency, or HACSA, of Lane County. HACSA is committed to provide safe, affordable, and energy-efficient housing for low-income families, elderly citizens, and persons with disabilities. The University of Oregon Government and Community Relations, coordinating the University of Oregon's legislative and advocacy efforts at the federal, state, and local levels. And our friends at KLCC 89.7 FM, New Oregonians. A special thanks to the Baker Center for graciously hosting us every week. According to national statistics, Oregon has a high number of incidents of harassment of school children arising from racial, ethnic, religious, or gender identity intolerance. The nature of a number of incidents in Eugene Springfield and area school seem to increase since the November 2016 U.S. presidential election. In this program, two local district superintendents and a parent of biracial children, who is also a teacher, will address strategies and responses as they are educating our children and what they're using to keep a safe, respectful, and nurturing environment for all young adults in the local schools. Some students in local schools have had experiences similar in many ways to those described in the book Between the World and Me by author Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's scheduled, by the way, to speak in Eugene February the 3rd. Today's City Club program will include perspectives on how students go about their lives in an environment that sometimes maybe is not welcoming or maybe hostile. Harassment and bullying can create an environment of intimidation in school and elsewhere. Panelists will give examples of incidents of harassment that arise from intolerance, how they are experienced by students, and how these threats to safety and success in school. So they're going to be talking to us about their efforts that we need to get behind as they are keeping our children safe in a nurturing, safe environment. After all, they are today's and tomorrow's leaders. They will be tomorrow's attorneys, tomorrow's business women and men. They will be tomorrow's leaders, both elected and non-elected officials. And at the end of the day, they are our children. With that in mind, Eugene District 4J Superintendent Dr. Gustavo Valderas will go first, followed by Springfield School District Superintendent Dr. Susan Ricky Smith, and they both will talk about their experiences and their efforts in supporting this type of environment. And Dr. Dina James, a teacher and parent whose biracial children attend local schools, and will be talking about her experiences. We also glad and welcome Scott Coltrane, who will be the first questionnaire. Members, now I ask for your help in welcoming Dr. Valderas to the podium.
Thank you, Juan Carlos, and thank you for inviting us here for this day. It's always a pleasure to be in front of City Club. First, I want to say that without students feeling safe and having a welcome environment, it's very difficult for them to learn. And we all know that, I think, as educators. So one of our goals always is safety first in front of our kids, make sure that they're feeling safe, their parents are feeling welcomed as well into our campuses. And that's something that we always strive for. I want to speak a little bit about our policies and practices, our trainings, and also my thoughts, and now my second year here as the Eugene School District Superintendent. I'm aware that we continue to have opportunity gaps that mirror national trends, and students may be receiving differentiated experiences across our campuses. We have 31 campuses, and want to communicate some of the specific items that we're doing to address those opportunity gaps and those issues that our students, particularly students of color, are facing. We have strong policies and practices. You know, 4J has always been a leader in policies and practices for inclusion. We had a bullying and harassment policy before it was required by the state in 2009. And we've also led the state in our gender adoption policy, our policy in gender that was adopted just 2015, that provides more of a safe environment for our students of diverse gender roles. But we have a lot of work to do yet, a lot of work to do in terms of our trainings, and we're going to talk a little bit about the trainings that we do. We have done a fantastic job here in 4J of training folks, of understanding folks from different backgrounds, whether it's coaching for educational leadership, CFE work, our courageous conversations that we currently do to supporting our student affinity groups, our Black student unions, our MECHA, students involved in MECHA, as well as students involved with other affinity groups throughout our system. Our goal is to try and help our students, but part of that is making sure that we have the right data systems and the right systems of support. So when I look at equity, I'm gonna go a little off script here. So when I look at equity, I look at systems or lack thereof systems. So equity to me is ensuring that we have systems to provide access for all students. Without those systems, we're always going to have inequities. So in 4J, that's the work that we have been doing, developing the systems. It could be a behavioral intervention system for students that struggle in the early years, or tier one, tier two, and tier three. Now I'm talking a little bit about educational language here in terms of different levels of support for students, depending on the behavioral needs, to academic supports for our students. We need to make sure that we have supports for those kids. And what you'll find in national trends is students of color sometimes struggle more than others. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about my experience. I come from a migrant family. I think maybe some of you have heard my story. I come from a small town in Nissa, Oregon. My parents were migrant workers from Piedras Negras, Coahuila, Mexico, which is northern Mexico. And I lived in a labor camp growing up. I don't know if people remember that in eastern Oregon. It used to be a Japanese internment camp. That's where I lived in. We had outside restrooms. We had no insulation. And if you've ever been in eastern Oregon, it gets cold in eastern Oregon. So colder than here. So my personal experiences growing up as a Spanish speaker, growing up in extreme poverty, but I was joking around with my staff the other day, you don't know you're poor unless if everybody around you lives the same way. So that's what I thought everybody was. Everybody did the same thing. It wasn't until I got to public schools that I saw that there was a difference and that people spoke English, not just Spanish. And in the camp, everybody was Mexican. Everybody was from Mexico. They were migratory from either South Texas or from northern or from Mexico. A lot of people from Michoacan, the state of Michoacan. So when I got to school, again, I have firsthand experience of the issues I faced, the issues of being pulled out and being taught English in a hallway for half the day, growing up in schools, having a struggle. My parents, and not being English speakers, not understanding the English system that I was going into. But what happened was, again, we had systems in place to support me and my brother. And again, I am living the American dream because of our Oregon public school system. This happened in Oregon, our Oregon public school system. Did I experience prejudice, harassment growing up? Oh, you bet. You bet I did. And I think the majority of people of color would say in a predominantly white state that they have experienced that. Be lying if they did, I'm speaking for myself. I'd be lying if I didn't say that I have experienced that. And I'm only speaking for myself. So not speaking for anybody else, any other person of color. But with that, it's a learning experience. How you react to situations, but also to make sure that I have caring adults that I can respond to, that I can go and seek input and say, hey, I'm feeling a little awkward here because of this situation. And the goal is to have caring adults in our system. And those are the teachers that we hire, the administrators, and the trainings that we provide. I think we can't do enough of that to help support kids like me, because there's a lot. Again, Lane County, I believe we had 5% Latinos. In 4J, 5% Latino population in 2000, we're now up to 15% in 2015. So the Latino population is increasing and will only increase. So for us to provide safe environments for all kids, to be able to be feel safe and secure, and to have a caring adult that they're able to talk to speak to, and then not only to speak to, then there's action. There needs to be action that's followed up with the student and the parent. That's essential. So those are the systems that we currently have in place. And I know in 4J we've made a tremendous effort to try and develop these systems. Based on our climate survey that we do every year for middle school and high school, we see it working because there's been less incidents of harassment and bullying the last few years. It's going down, but students are feeling safe to report. That's going up. So students are feeling safer to report, and our incidents are going down. So that's something that is absolutely says that we're doing the right work, but we have a lot more to do. We have a lot more to do. I am blessed to have a wonderful staff. My senior staff is phenomenal, and they're doing the right work to create these systems. And that's something that I fully expect my community to hold me accountable and my staff accountable for those systems, and to ensure that those kids, every kid has equal access and opportunity across all our campuses. So that's something that you can hold me accountable to that. That's why I'm here. I'm here because there's kids in school. And my job is to focus on kids. So, and to guide this district that I'm very, it's a very healthy district to move it forward with the development of these systems for opportunity. And I'm talking for all kids. I think sometimes we focus on students because there's a tremendous need. I also don't want to forget about the students that are talented and gifted. They're also marginalized out here because we don't provide enough support for them. And those kids in the middle, I always say those kids in the middle, those 3.0 kids that are right there that never have any problems at all, but they're kind of lost in the middle. Well, we need to push those kids from the middle a little higher, and that's our job. So, but I know this program was really regarding bullying harassment, and I can tell you that there are incidents of bullying and harassment in our schools. There are incidents of bullying and harassment in our schools. Our job is to take every incident seriously and work with folks to train our administrators, train our teachers on how to respond, and respond in an effective manner. I think that's what the community expects, and that's what I expect. So, and we do have processes in place, and that will speak to that. But I'm also want to speak to Lane County as a whole. Because Juan Carlos, you mentioned Lane County as a whole. 16 school district superintendents work very closely together along with Larry Sullivan, the county superintendent, to ensure that we're in a collaborative. We meet monthly to talk about issues and meet monthly to talk and share. And that's been one of these opportunities that's sometimes not, it doesn't happen everywhere. We kind of all like each other, right? Which is what you expect. So we get along with each other, and we share information, we share staff, and that's something that is something that's unique to Lane County, is that collaborative feel of, hey, we're in this together. And look forward to the continued work, and look forward to the questions. So I'm going to turn it over back to Juan Carlos.
All right, folks, let's just get right on to the next speaker, Superintendent of Springfield School District, Dr. Susan Rickey-Smith. Please come.
Thank you, Juan Carlos, and I want to say thank you to the City Club of Eugene for giving me the opportunity to be with my esteemed colleague, Dr. Balderas, and with all of you here, Deanna, and others. The joy of going second is you can easily say ditto and move forward. But I think, you know, if I might diverge from my text for just a moment, I want to share a little bit about where I come from. Dr. Balderas and I couldn't be any more different in the way in which we grew up. I am a white woman of privilege. I was raised by two university professors, one of whom went on to be a state and private university president. In 1968, when I was 12 years old, and you can do the math about how old I am now, but I know it's safe in this room and it won't go out of here. In 1968, in May of that year, the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, My father, in his esteemed wisdom, decided this was the time we needed to take a trip to the Deep South. And so for the first time in my life, in traveling, we were headed to Louisiana, where he was presenting at a medical conference. He was a professor of medicine originally. I had an opportunity to firsthand come face to face with segregation. I saw children my age living in conditions I couldn't even imagine. Staying in hotels in some of these smaller Deep South communities as we traveled, I saw the first evidences of National Guard and dogs and fire hoses used on people. When we got to Louisiana, to New Orleans, I learned that I couldn't speak to staff of color because they would not address me. They were told not to address individuals who are white, and I didn't understand, because I came from a university background where I went to school with children of a variety of cultures and races, but I didn't realize how privileged I was. That left a profound impact on me as a 12-year-old, and my original career, then I chose to go into nursing and healthcare because I believe in four fundamental rights. The right to healthcare, the right to a roof over your head, the right to a full belly at the end of the day, and the right to an education. So I went into nursing, into trauma, to which my educator friend said, well, how did that serve you in education? There isn't a day that I don't triage some trauma. And from there into public health, and had the opportunity to establish what were called well-child clinics, but we really were indigent care. And so again, it gave me a profound sense of my sense of privilege and how blessed I was and how I had to do more listening and less talking to get to action that would truly impact the lives of others in an equitable way. I was blessed with the opportunity to spend some time to take time to raise our three daughters. And when I came back into the workforce, I said to my husband one evening, I think I'd like to explore the concept of educating rather than going back into nursing so I can have more time with the children, because I'd done a lot of volunteer work. And I said to my husband, and to this day he reminds me of this, I said, how tough can being a teacher be? Seriously. You know, I've stood knee deep in bodies in an ER. How tough can this be? Okay. It's tough. It's tough work, but it's the right work. I fundamentally believe, along with education, that it is there to change lives. It's not there just to add quality to life. It is there to change lives. And so to the question that's in front of us today relative to what our children are experiencing, I am an ESL-endorsed teacher, and I had the privilege of teaching in nothing but Title I schools and to second-language learners. I was a Title I assistant principal at McKay High School of 2,200 kids, many of them dealing with gangs and drugs and other types of issues. I was privileged to then serve as a principal of a middle school that fed into that school and lead it through a federal restructure under a No Child Left Behind. And in 3 years' time, not because of me, but because of that staff and their commitment to students of color and gender diversity, we were able to turn that school around and close the gaps in reading and in mathematics for all of our subgroups, every last one of them. I was then privileged to go on in Salem-Keizer School District to serve as the Director of Instructional Services and oversee federal programs, including our language programs, for over 67 schools in that system. And now I have the profound honor to serve as the superintendent for Springfield Public Schools, and I bring that experience with me. As a teacher, as an administrator, and now as a superintendent, there has not been a day or a year within my work where I have not been confronted with racial harassment reports from our students. We are proud in Springfield to be able to say that we have the PBIS system that has come to us from the university, and that helps us to take a look at our reported incidences of harassment and bullying and to disaggregate that across subgroups. But that's not enough. I am right there with Dr. Balderas. It is about a system of supports. And we appreciate the partnership that we have with Eugene Forget, who has led the way in this area, and we are mirroring those results. We have an equity cadre that is made up of a diverse group of individuals, gender and racial, that help us determine how to deepen our equity practices within the district. They will be bringing forward as part of their work with the National Equity Project that we have in partnership this year with them, and we will probably have partnership with them over the next several years, to develop and bring forth policy to our board to consider a umbrella of policies relative to discrimination and harassment, and using an equity lens to really guide our work. I believe in a ground-up rather than a top-down system, because then every member of our system has ownership of equity. Additionally, when I first came into the role as a superintendent, one of my tenets is equity of outcome for all, not just access, but equity of outcome for all. And so our data systems are set up in terms of absentee rates, in terms of discipline rates, in terms of academic achievement and growth. And we disaggregate the data. Yesterday, I stood in front of over 20 administrators in our system. We have 20 schools. And I told them as they were coming into first semester, here are the data points I want you to be cognizant of. And when I come out to your schools over the next 2 weeks, I want you to be able to report to me. What is your discipline rate across subgroups? What is your absentee rate across subgroups? What is your academic achievement across subgroups? What we expect, we have to inspect. And to Dr. Balderas' point of building a culture where students feel more comfortable reporting, that is the work that is in front of us. And I can proudly say in the last year and a half that the ability for students to report has gone up while we're working to try to, again, help those instances go down. One of my greatest joys in the last several months has been the day after the elections, when we had reports across our district of increased rates of harassment related to both racial as well as gender identity. By noon of that day, I was on the phone with Dr. Balderas, and I said, what are you hearing in your district? And he said, I'm hearing the same. I said, what do you think about us releasing a joint letter that says to our communities, we are safe havens. We are places where we are to teach and to encourage respectful discourse, and that we will not tolerate harassment. And Dr. Balderas' first words to me was, you betcha, I'm right there with you. It is such a joy to be able to work with a partner who is with you in that work. And I want to say thank you to you directly, Gus, for that partnership, truly. It makes a big difference. Because we are not just Eugene 4J. We are not just Springfield Public Schools. We are a community where children move back and forth. And they need to experience the same sense of safety and welcome, and the fact that they are being encouraged and expected to learn, and that we are there to support them in so doing. I'm right there with Dr. Balberis. We have a lot of work ahead of us. And my work as a woman of privilege is to continue to listen and listen deeply, and to make sure that I understand before I act, and not act alone, but to act in partnership with those who have boots on the ground, who are living this experience, and can help me see what barriers we may unintentionally be putting up that need to be pulled away. That is the commitment. And I can't think of a better time, for as challenging as these times are, I can't think of a better time to be living. I can't think of better work to be doing. And I can't think of better partners to be with in doing this work. Thank you.
I see it as a privilege to hear directly from a parent. That is when the district and Dr. Dina James. Will you come to the podium, please?
So I want to thank the City Club for inviting me today. My name is Dina James, and I am a parent in 4J, and I am also a teacher in 4J. And first of all, I'm all over the place because I have like 10 pages of notes, and I'm probably not going to like have any kind of order to them, but I will do my best. So looking at the subject today, it covers a lot of ground, and I know it's talking about incidents of harassment and intolerance and in our system. And there's a couple of incidents I want to bring up that my kids have experienced, and I have four children. Right now they're age 14, 16, 17, 21. You do the math again on that one. I was busy for a few days. in those years. But anyway, two are girls and two are boys. The oldest two are girls. The youngest two are young men. And most of the schooling has been done here in Eugene at 4J. So I'd like to go back to when my oldest, who is now a senior at University of Buffalo, double majoring and getting a minor, just an outstanding student and community servant and athlete. She's had to really prove herself hard. You know, it's been hard for her to prove herself, but she's, you know, all of my kids have really done amazing, so far. When Riley was in fifth grade, she was at a local elementary school here in PE and running around with all the other kids, and a young boy called her the N-word, and he started hitting her with a jump rope. So immediately the PE teacher, you know, had the boy go out of class, and they did call me, brought me down to the school. I said, what are you going to do about that? Oh, well, we're talking to the boy's parents. I'm like, no, what are you going to do about that? You know, that's not okay. And I, you know, ended up calling the district. And this is before your time, Dr. Balderas, you're off the hook. So what ended up happening, and which has happened with a lot of these incidents in the school system, is that they are swept under the rug. And a lot of these issues don't ever go past the school buildings themselves. I don't think they often, you know, I think now it might be different, but in the past, it's they're just kind of shut down, swept under the rug. My wish for that would have been it happened in front of other kids. Other kids saw that. I don't think my daughter is validated. And I think a lot of our kids of color are not validated when they are discriminated against or treated unfairly. They need that validation. They need to be told in front of other people that is not tolerable behavior, that is not okay. I had also an incident with my youngest son, Zach, when he was in elementary school. He was pulled out of his class by the principal. Well, she called me, called me into her office and was very proudly telling me, oh, I spoke to your son today. Your son told, I wanted to talk to him about what it's like to be the only kid of color in his classroom. So I asked him, hey, Zach, what does it feel like to be the only African-American in your class? And we talked about it, and it was a really good talk. And, I've gone through all this cultural competency training, and, she is so proud of herself, for having this conversation. I sat there just unbelieving in what I was hearing, because our children have a way of developing their own identity. I don't think my son really saw himself as being that different than anybody else. He was part of a class. He was part of his peer group. And when the principal brings you out of a classroom and asks you how it feels to be different, that starts the ball rolling. It starts for a child that they feel they don't belong. You know, we talk about harassment. We talk about, you're talking about the welcoming environment for children, feeling included. Well, they don't feel included if they're pulled out and told that they're different. I have many more incidences, and also in our community, this still continues in our community. I had an incident with my boys at Costco a few weeks ago, and I quickly posted it on Facebook because, of course, it upset me. But a lady, there's all those lovely samples, right? And I have these, like, two teenage boys that are huge and brown. And, so we're at Costco, and, of course, they're going to try every sample, but they're very, very polite. So we stand in, the line, we wait. Sometimes people jump in front of them, they still wait. They're very kind boys, but when it came their turn to try their sample, these big kids go up there and, they got to try the two different samples, so they're waiting for the second one, and a lady says to them, can you get those football players or basketball players out of the way so the rest of us can get a chance to get in there? And I'm like, what? Anyway, I took a lot for me to control myself, because those type of comments are racist. They're racist. And I don't know what she was thinking, but pretty much the whole crowd around this little sample table was, jaws were dropped, and people approached me later saying, I'm so sorry you had that experience. you know, and my boys came to me, they said, "Mom, was that racist?" I'm like, "Yes, that was racist." Yeah, because he goes, "Oh, I thought she was just asking if we played basketball or football." I'm like, "Oh, so sorry, boys." But my, you know, my kids are awesome. My son, Zach, and one of my daughters, they're both on IEPs, which are called Individual Education Plans. Another issue I want to bring up, kids of color are more likely to be identified as special ed, and we need to keep addressing that issue. I also want to talk about some of the data collection systems. We, right now in 4J, it's very inconsistent with our the reporting of incidences. And I'm kind of on a flip side. I'm kind of like 10 things happening at once. Okay, so we use a system, a data collection system. Everyone in 4J has access to it, and it's called SWIS. And this is for reporting all incidences, majors, minors, behavioral incidences. It is being used inconsistently in our district. My school that I work at, I'm really grateful that I get to sit on a committee that goes over this data at least once a month and problem solves. But we do get to piece it out. We do get to look at some of the subgroups and some of, you know, who are we pinging? You know, who are we pulling out? Who are we giving, you know, getting referrals for? And even in our little school, we see that we are more identifying kids with these behavioral problems as being kids of color. And we need to look at that. And I know this is happening at other schools. I did bring my son, Zach, who's now 14, 6'3", basketball player, football player, but like the giant teddy bear kind of kid. He has a 23-page record of student discipline profile from our school district. There's 60 incidences since he's been in kindergarten of him being pulled out and given referrals. So on the, he pulled someone's sweater. Oh, he ate in the school bus, and he was told not to. Oh, he took a knife to school to cut his grapefruit because that was his favorite food. So on here it says, brought a weapon to school, brought a knife. That's all it says. On and on and on. So there's 23 pages, and you're all welcome to read it. It's quite entertaining. But the point of this is, another thing that hasn't been brought up is kids of color are more identified to be disciplined and to get the suspensions, detentions. I'd like us to really look at that data. And the data we get from SWIS is very, very good. It's like we can really see where we're doing wrong. And it's not about let's get those kids, let's punish those kids. But it's about restorative justice. It's about giving them natural consequences, not kicking them out of school and suspending them. We need to find better ways. We need to look at the child, their story, listen to their voice. What got them to that point to push another kid away? What's the real story? Are you going to write up a kid because there's incidences going on and harassment and they just couldn't take it anymore? Also, I'd like to, one more thing, well, not one more thing, there's a lot more in here, but anyway, just the fact that every student has a story, and it is so important for us to listen to that child. And children of color, we need to create a space for them, and we need to make time to hear their voice and not just look at their behavior, because their behavior is telling us something. Their behavior is telling us that there's something deeper and there's something going on, and we need to look at that. And to be continued. Thank you.
Our first questioner, we're so pleased that he has taken the time to join us at this very important program, is Scott Coltrane, and who served several years as the Dean of the University of Oregon College of Arts and Sciences before being named Provost and Senior Vice President in February 2014.
Let me set this up with a little bit of information about what we're doing at the University of Oregon. Just this last week, our students have put together a campaign called Reset the Code, and it's basically a respect campaign. So my question is, at the secondary level or the middle school level, what have you seen that works for really helping the students take collective responsibility for stopping that kind of behavior?
At Springfield, as part of this equity cadre work that we have, we also have a student voice group. And these are students from across the high schools. And they come together every month to learn together around social issues and around social injustice or social justice themes. And then they go out and they present back into their high schools and support that type of work through their leadership groups and other ways of interacting with students. They present it at the Oregon Leadership Network, which is a statewide network focused to racial equality and gender equality in education across the state. And just as recently as before what I call the apocalyptic winter set in, right before our winter break at Springfield High School, the students themselves, much to what you've just identified, Dr. Coltrane, did a little sticky note for every single student in the school, something that they wanted that student to know why they appreciated them. And they put them up across the school. And it's on our webpage, and it's also on my Twitter feed. The students then spent the day looking for their sticker and looking for who had said something about them and why they liked them. And the ones that I smiled the most about were the ones that were written bilingually by a student who isn't bilingual to a student who is bilingual. Now, if that doesn't tell you, when you take a look at data and you're thinking about what is the response, that tells me about a very profound, deep reflection on the part of that student in response to this other student. And then you had the sticker and you got a cup of hot chocolate and a candy cane and, you know, a picture with me. So, which was not the highlight of their day, but it wasn't mine. So I think to that point, and what was really impactful, I think, for me was when I said to the students, and what's next? They said, oh, there's so much more to do, Dr. Sue. There's so much more to do. So I'm encouraged by that, and our job now is to come around that and continue to build that up and to help them move that forward.
So thank you for the question. For 4J, each of our schools at the secondary level have student clubs or student organizations, student leadership groups, and what I've seen a lot of happen is more of this character education piece that's been missing sometimes in our schools is trying to infuse more of that even in our elementary schools and make sure that students understand character education, more of a civics education as well. So pieces that have been missing in our curriculum and how that looks like. So some things I've seen around our community is a pass it forward type of campaign where students, again, pass it forward and more of the goodwill gestures between kids, but also students really do a nice job of promoting themselves. We have fantastic students in all the school districts that have been in, and this is no different. Fantastic students that are very, very clear thinkers. So if we listen to kids, they're more right than they are wrong as adults. So one of the things is making sure kids that we have access to student voice. And it's something that's very, very powerful here in 4J as well as Bethel and Springfield and the rest of the Lane County schools is listen to student voice as much as we can because, again, what they say, they're living it each day. We as adults sometimes don't. Yeah, we hear bits and pieces. We do teach them, but we learn from them as much as they learn from us.
Now, let us break for about 5 minutes to formulate your questions. So let's break for about 5 minutes and come back.
You're listening to KLCC NPR for Oregonians in Eugene 89.7 FM KLCC, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1 KMPQ Roseburg, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet.
John Anik, a City Club member since 2003. I'm also a retired teacher from the Palo Alto schools, and I attended a Black Student Union meeting in our high school one time, and I asked the question, there was talk about harassment, I asked the question about how many of you have experienced harassment coming and going from school on the part of the police department in Palo Alto, and every male student in the group raised their hand, and half the females as well. This is out of a group of about 30 students, evenly divided, male and female. And I would apply that same question here. To what extent do Eugene and Springfield students experience police harassment, either coming to or going from school?
Thank you so much for the question. I'm not able to speak to the issue relative to police harassment. And we have two school resource officers that are on our that we have a contract with in terms of our school safety. But I can speak to incidences from the community of harassment. And as late as right before winter break, a student came to my office to report that as she was traversing from one of our high schools home, that she had been confronted by a community member and was able to describe this individual. And so we made a report to the police relative to that. But specific to police harassment, I unfortunately wouldn't have that data. But we do know that there are elements within our community that engage in that manner. And the good news is that our students are becoming much more visible and feeling more comfortable about reporting that so that we can take care and move forward in addressing that issue. Because safety to and from school is also important for us.
Dina, you want to go next?
So I am really actually, I've lived in Eugene most of my life, we live in Portland a little bit, Indiana and Colorado also, but most of my life I've been here. And I know for Eugene Police Department, I feel like for the youth that I've been in contact with and even our community, I think we have, this is my opinion, not based on data, but I think we have a really good police department in Eugene for the most part. I have privilege, though, and I also know it's not always been that way. I've never driven perfectly all my life, and I've never actually been pulled over for many things I've probably done. I'm not going to go any farther than that. But I do know the men of color in Eugene have shared many stories of getting pulled over many, many times. And the Latinos and African Americans, and just if your skin is not like mine, they have a lot of stories to tell about their experiences. So I, listen to folks talk about that, and I don't know about the youth. I haven't had any experience in that area. Thanks.
And Dr. Valderas, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, like my colleague, Dr. Ricky Smith, I don't have police data, but we are responsible for kids to and from campus and local parentis, and we do take care of any issues and work with law enforcement. We as well have school resource officers that we contract with and have been very, very supportive in taking care and addressing issues, but with regards to the specific question regarding police harassment, I cannot speak to that, but I can speak to the support that we provide students to and from campus, safe routes to school. So, thank you.
All right, next question.
Linda Jensen, City Club member. I was born and raised in Hawaii and was frequently the only white child in my class, and I experienced a lot of harassment, not only from students, but also from my teachers. And so I wanted to find out about the training that you have for your teachers and whether or not you know if your students are comfortable in reporting staff harassing students.
With regards to trainings for staff, we in Eugene, we've done a tremendous job over the past few years with training staff, with Coaching for Educational Equity, for having courageous conversations, as well as looking at implicit bias training as well, that we are doing more of. I know we had our admin trained on that last year. And our goal is to, we've done such a great job that we need to differentiate. I think that's the one thing for us in Eugene is we have staff that have been highly, highly trained, that need very specific, maybe more specific training, and as well as making sure our new teachers are trained as well. And so, again, differentiated training along the lines, and that's something that we're putting together in a more comprehensive manner. Before, it was really, we just had these trainings, you've gone through them, again, having the systems in place to ensure that we have accountability to who's gone through the trainings as well. But those are trainings that we offer for our staff and our administrators.
Thank you. And it, relative to, you've heard me speak about our equity cadre, we have a system in Springfield where we have half-day release, early releases, so that staff can come together and do professional development across a variety of topics. One of the things that I'm proud to say is that our association, our teachers association, came to me last year and said, what can we do about equity training and how can we facilitate that? And so the equity cadre developed a beginning modules of professional development relative to the population that we are serving in Springfield, how it's changed, equity issues that need to be considered and thought through, and that work is continuing this year and will certainly deepen with our work with the National Equity Project. Additionally, relative to reports of staff, we take those all complaints, and we have a policy on within district that speaks to staff harassment, and so we take those reports very seriously, and we address them. Our community has had a number of issues that have been very public, and we have worked through them relative to interactions that were not what we would expect our teachers to have with our students of diversity. So we take them seriously, we take them on head on, and we work through in terms of having respectful conversations, but continually working to deepen our teachers' understandings of that. Part of that is also training our parents and our students to feel safe, to step up and report so that we can work through that. And I resonate to a comment that Dina made relative to restorative justice. This is probably the next step in terms of our work, is taking a look at what opportunities do we have to bring parties, aggrieved parties, together and learn together and understand the impact of words and actions as a part of that ongoing professional development.
I just want to talk on this. Going back to the data collection system that we have access to, the Swiss data collection system, one part of this system is showing who's accountable, showing which teachers are making these punishments to the kids. If we can do this consistently throughout our district, we can start to kind of pull out who is making these referrals. We can see if numbers of kids of color are being more highly identified, and maybe there's certain teachers. Racism and prejudice is a very much of an implicit thing. It's not something that's, you know, I'm not going to write down, hey, I was discriminated against a kid that speaks Spanish, you know, and it's not going to be out there. I'm going to say I'm nice to everyone, and I'm fair, and I'm competent, and I'm a good person. I treat everyone the same. I'm going to say that it comes out in a different way, and if we have a consistent way to even start looking at some of that data, we can actually start pulling out the teachers and educators that need greater training in that area. Thank you.
Okay, so before we go to the next question, we have just a couple more minutes to get a question in, but here's what I'd like us to do. So there's at least 7 or 8 people of you that are waiting. What I'd like you to do is write down your question, and we'd like to forward those questions to our guests, and hopefully they'll be kind enough to respond to those questions, and we'll ask our administrator to post them on our website. And so if you kindly write down your question, because I believe that this is obviously of interest, so maybe have Sandra collect those questions. If you haven't formulated in your head, can you bring them from your head and put them in writing, and we'll have our guest speakers to respond to those questions. So we have literally only 2 more people that we can go through, and then we'll need to conclude this very interesting program. Go ahead, sir.
I'm Dr. Hank Elder. I'm a psychiatrist, and I've been with the City Club for a year. With regard to the points that we were to discuss, the problem behaviors, how to eradicate it, how specific practices to eradicate and ultimately heal the effects. And as a psychiatrist, I'm most interested in the specifics about what your program, which Dr. Baldera specifically, in the Eugene schools, what can you do to deal with the effects of harassment and bullying in the schools?
How to deal with the effects. I think that's part of the restorative justice piece that Dr. Ricky Smith has commented to, as well as the baseline piece of having programs in place, systems in place across all our campuses that are consistent to ensure that kids are receiving that that we have similar expectations for kids. It's about training, but for example, the positive behavior intervention support systems that we have that are, again, climate building, as well as restorative justice practices that are more engaging in smaller groups with kids. But we also looked at, again, my experiences, what we've had before, maybe not here in 4J's, peer mentoring, peer mediation. And my own son was involved with a peer mediation effort when he was a peer mediator, and that seemed to help a little bit. It's more being able to talk through things. To me, it's about communication and understanding. We need to be able to communicate and understand what's happening, and do it in a, it's been mentioned before, with civil discourse. Being able to do it in an authentic manner where it's not a blame game. It's we are there to try and solve something. I think that's crucial to me. And being a former high school counselor, used to do those, and just making sure that we get to the table and have people feel that, again, we're human beings and how we treat each other. I think that's essential, and that's where I like to have everything be, is be able to have that discourse. But being as a, you know, from your profession, is getting students to get there to the table, and are they ready to have that discourse? I think that's part of the something that we need to work on, is making sure everybody's ready to be able to have that dialogue, or else it's not meaningful and it's not authentic. So, thank you.
Jerry, anybody else? Okay, last question.
Yes, Jerry Smith. Poverty and homelessness affects children of color at a rate of about twice as much as other children, and 45% of all our children are in poverty. We're in a terrible situation with children. How does poverty affect the kids that you see?
You want to go first, Dr. Ricky Smith?
Thank you for that question, and I think it's an important one because I think there has been a long national discourse about the impacts of poverty, but never the disaggregated or more granular discussion about poverty and race, and the not just additive but almost synergistic effect of that. And so, you know, poverty is huge. Poverty is huge. You heard me talk about my four rights, right? What I think are the four rights. You know, a child that comes to school without a full belly or food insecurity is huge. They can't learn. And behaviors come as a course of that. A child that is homeless or is basically one step ahead of the rent. My first year teaching in the Salem Kaiser School District was a fifth grade ESL teacher. My classroom of 35 students turned over twice that year. So I saw over 70 students because of poverty, and they were one step ahead. So what happens is gaps in learning occur because they're moving from one school to the next, to the next, to the next. And it's mindful, I'm mindful of that as a superintendent, when we think about how not only what we teach, but in what order we teach it, knowing that we have the same mobility. So if a child is going from Mount Vernon Elementary to Douglas Gardens to Centennial to whatever, they stand half a chance that they stay in our system of not having too many gaps in instruction because we're pretty much all not lockstep, but we're pretty much in order of what we're teaching. That is an impact of poverty that I think about a great deal. In terms of discipline behaviors, it is directly related. If I don't have a full belly and I don't know where I'm going to sleep tomorrow night, and I know that that teacher is asking me for an assignment that I don't even have a place to do, you know, my behavior is going to go through the roof. So this is also part of our work with our teachers, is to understand when you are working with kiddos of poverty, here are the things that they won't show you because they're proud. You know, we talk a lot about grit and persistence. You know, kids of poverty have grit and persistence. Grit and persistence is really a white affluent problem. It is not a problem of poverty. Okay, so that's part of our work with teachers, is to understand when that child blows out or when that child doesn't have the assignment, let's dig a little deeper and really understand what's going on, and then mitigate. And, you know, back to the apocalyptic winter that we've had here, I think deeply about closing school because I know a vast majority of my children will not be getting a meal that day or two, and that my children will not be in safe buildings where it's warm. Okay, so all of that goes into do we call school or not? That's also a big piece of it for us.
And, you know, James, you have anything to add, or Dr. Valderas?
I'd like to add, at our school, that's huge. The kids that come to our school that have, when you're homeless, when you're in poverty, it's very stressful. Parents are stressed out. There's a lot of tension. It's not a good place to be. I've been there myself for several years, and I know what it feels like. And so my kids are taking, you know, those kids are taking it to school. We talked about creating that safe and welcoming environment, and to me that is huge. So if our kids are bouncing off the walls or angry or hurt or tired or stressed out at school, we need to understand that where that's coming from. That's not something that should be punished. I know there's, you know, a lot of great viral videos going around about the, you know, meditation instead of punishment. You know, having those quiet spaces, having that soothing music, having a warm, safe, relaxing environment. Well, I just thoroughly support that. These kids that are coming, and you know, they are having increased behavioral problems, but a lot of that is due to, you know, they have a hard life. It's not easy, and we need to embrace them, love them, know that they belong. There's a sense of welcoming and home, and I don't know how you teach that. I know we have that culture in my school, and I'm really grateful for that. That's all I have. Thank you.
Dr. Valdez, have anything to add, or we're good? Okay. Before we thank our guest today, there are a couple of quick announcements. Thank you, Hummingbird Wholesale, and owners Julie and Charlie Tilt for hosting this week's meeting of the Lane Workforce Partnership, Lane County Economic and Empowerment course. This course helps teachers become familiar with local businesses in order to help high school students identify potential jobs after graduation. The City Club of Eugene also thanks our sponsors, including Housing and Community Services Agency, HACSA of Lane County, University of Oregon Government and Community Relations, and KLCC 89.7 Radio. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County for televising City Club programs Monday through Friday at noon, Saturday at 10:30 a.m., and Sunday at 9 p.m. Next week, we have the program called This Oregon's Low Vaccination Rate, a Public Health Crisis. That's a really good question that should be well attended. Hope you can join us. Folks, for this program, like me and as a personal and individual member, I strongly believe that education continues to be the greatest equalizer. And we must be willing to take the steps to support those educators and those who see our children firsthand in their efforts. I ask that you take that step. Sometimes it is support, sometimes it's to listen, and sometimes it's through your funds. So whenever we see gaps, let's find a way for us to look into that. So thank you all to support our programs. Additional information about programs and upcoming events, you can find them at www.cityclubofeugene.org. Join me in saying thank you to our guest speakers, Dr. Gustavo Valderas, Dr. Susan Reckes-Smith, and Dr. Dina James. And of course, our first questionnaire, Dr. Scott Coltrane. So, my name is Juan Carlos Valle. This concludes today's program. Thank you so much.